This is the SCLO Library Podcast. A few episodes ago, we had Dr. John Gastel on the podcast talking about his studies of deliberative democracy. But during our conversation, it came up that he had a new novel coming out as well. One aspect of his new novel that is special to my heart is that his novel focuses on role-playing. For anyone who might not know, role-playing is a type of game where a moderator, sometimes called a game master, sets the stage for a story and the other players play characters in that story, and collectively the group creates a narrative. So it has everything that's great about fiction, but then it's also participatory. Its appeal is pretty broad, but I wouldn't call it mainstream, I believe because people think of it as a type of game rather than a type of fiction. As I record this, I see out through the stacks and the tens of thousands of titles of fiction here. Our community loves to read. If you love fiction, but you haven't considered taking a more active role in the fiction in your life, you might find role-playing to be a great way to exercise your imagination and creativity. There are several groups who play through SCLO. If you contract any of my excitement about role-playing and want to try it out, there is a link in the episode's description where you can find out more info on what we are doing here at the library. We'll be talking with Dr. Gastel about role-playing in a bit, but first I wanted to check in with one of my oldest gaming compatriots to see what role-playing has meant to him. My first guest is Hansen Bergamini. Hansen is an educator in Santa Fe and someone who I've been discussing gaming with for over 30 years. So Hansen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be here.
Hansen, what have role-playing games meant to you, and have you introduced your two sons into them yet?
It was a really, really large part of my childhood, and I think shaped the way I go about the world and think about the world a little bit. But every once in a while, I kind of throw them at my kids, because I think, like, my vocabulary and, you know, like I said, some of the ways I think were really affected by it, and there is probably, on one hand, I want, you know, every parent has some desires to want their kid to be a little bit like them. But on the other hand, there's value there for sure. And I think opening up the imagination and like specifically the vocabulary, I've thought about the vocabulary a lot. People ask me like, how do you know what that is? And it's all D&D. I'm sure you've had the same experience.
I actually remember I was not a great student and struggled with reading. And I remember just spending hours with some source books, I think in ninth grade, and my dad actually commenting that I didn't seem as dumb as I did. I'm sorry, but in nicer terms. But he actually said, you know, I think it's because you got your nose in those books all the time. So.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I wouldn't say it turned me into a reader because I liked reading only for fun. I didn't really like reading for school, but it did turn me into, like, you know, as a teacher myself, watching some of my colleagues try to teach informational reading and writing is like some of the most painful stuff they have to do. Yeah. And in a weird way, reading those source books definitely gave me a big head start on like being interested in informational reading, if that makes sense. You know, like I was reading it to process all the rules, and I wanted to know all the rules. And I picked up a lot of things by accident on the way.
Yeah. Well, that's education at its best, right? When it gets Trojan horsed into your brain.
Yeah. And my teacher certainly had nothing to do with it.
You just mentioned the rule set or mechanics of games that can be at times complex. In this case, Dungeons and Dragons or D&D. But this is true of many games. I feel like a complex rule set is sometimes a barrier for entry for prospective players, which is a shame.
Originally, the massive rules behind D&D, and there were a lot of them, you know, it's like, in a way, it's still one of the most complex games I've ever played because they had to simulate the real world and provides mechanics for everything they could think of.
Right.
Yeah. Literally jumping, swimming, climbing a wall. Stuff like that. It's just, so, you know, they had to do all this stuff to present mechanics to the player because otherwise you're left with someone in the room, probably the game master, being like, no, you can't climb the wall. And it seems too arbitrary. You know, the player wants to interact with the world in a way that seems less arbitrary than that, I guess.
Yeah, you need some way to determine what's the probability of stuff happening, of being able to pull off any specific feat, I guess.
Yeah, and so it's funny because it's so D&D and the early precursor RPGs, the role-playing games, like had to create these sprawling rule sets to encompass such a open-ended world.
Lately, I've been thinking about role-playing not as a type of game, but rather a type of fiction. And reading fiction is great. It takes you on all sorts of adventures, and you can see through all these different eyes and perspective. But there's something inherently solitary and passive about it. Mm-hmm. With role-playing, you get that same change in setting and perspective that reading fiction delivers, but it's collaborative and active. You're not being told what happens. You're in charge of a character, a kind of piece of the narrative. And there's something special about that. I wonder if when role-playing first began, like it grew out of wargaming, and so it grew out of kind of dice. I wonder if it had grown out of storytelling originally, if we would think of it the same way. So with your example of like a character wants to climb a wall and the game master has to decide if that's possible or not, and so there's dice that, you know, you roll. I wonder if that's necessary. Could it just be, if there's no reason that it can't happen, it does happen. Like if the character wants to climb the wall, why not? Why, yeah. If, like anything that would make for a cool part to the story collectively as the people come together, maybe it does, maybe that just happens. Like, I feel like when we're looking at games, sometimes we let the games be in charge rather than the people be in charge.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I went to this summer camp every year for a little while. I was in Vermont. It was called Adventure Quest. And we'd do stuff like kayak and rock climb and all sorts of outdoorsy stuff. We had camp counselors that knew D&D. We kind of were like lamenting that we had this, you know, none of us had our books or our dice and we couldn't do it. And one of the camp counselors was like, what are you talking about? Like, we're going to have a game tonight. A lot of us were like the D&D nerd types being like, but how would you know? And the dice, but the dice and the rules. And he was like, no, I'm going to be your game master. And when you throw a dagger at someone, I'm going to tell you if it hits. And if you try to run away from a goblin, like, I'm going to tell you if it works out. And, you know, it was really cool. And it's kind of we weren't held back by all the mechanics. We did like a whole adventure with him, this guy, in a night. Right. And he was a good storyteller. And I did like that we weren't beholden to the rules like you're talking about. It was a fun experience. But there was another part of it too. And maybe it was just because I was too young. There was an arbitrary aspect, you know, like it really requires the game master or the dungeon master to be a really good storyteller and sort of manage the player's emotions all at once, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, I think ideally what you're talking about is like the ideal version of D&D, but I think it can be hard to pull off, I think.
Oh, for sure. And I think one important thing is to know what everyone is signing up for. Like, hopefully everyone has a similar vision, since there is such a wide spectrum of available ways in which someone could be role-playing. If someone does want a dungeon crawl every night and someone else wants a very narrative, heavy thing, those two might be mutually exclusive in any given minute. And so hopefully there can be a vision that accommodates what everyone's looking for. Do you remember the first time that we ever played together? What I remembered, and maybe this was later, but when we were going down to Florida in the camper.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is well before, we're all old gazers. This is well before tablets. And so all we had was time. I think there was like some six-sided dice in like a Monopoly game or something.
No, you're right. I think that was the first time.
And I remember not knowing what I was doing. I had just recently started playing at school, but I just kind of started talking and then we were playing. And There were frost giants, I remember. And I think a magic pear.
Obviously. Oh my God. You know what? You're sparking memories in me. You made like a list of items you could get. Huh. Just like, you know, like 20 things. And we like looked at it like with such awe. Yeah, that was a big moment, I think. I'm surprised I forgot about that.
That's one neat thing is it's kind of like the soccer. Like I watch soccer on TV and wonder, how is the sport so popular? And I think it's because it doesn't take anything. Like you can play all across the world because all you need is a ball.
Yeah.
A ball and a bunch of people. Role playing, all you need is some time and people. And you're good to go. Just open up your brain and whatever comes out, that's what, you know, you guys can do.
You know, I totally agree with you, and that's amazing.
I know you play a lot of online games. What is the difference in how you see folks get treated online versus when you're in person gaming with them?
Well, it's pretty extreme. Yeah. So I'm sure a lot of your listeners and you have heard and talked about anonymity on the internet being a force for toxicity for sure. And I would agree with all those points, you know, like it sure does change human interaction when you aren't face to face and you just sort of feel like you're behind a veil and your ordinary etiquette and, you know, good naturedness might fall to the side, some more than others, it seems. So you can have good experiences, but yeah, there's something about being in a room, even if you don't know everyone there, you know, with your like food and your dice and whatnot, that lends itself to a lot better of an experience most of the time. Just the face to face puts people maybe not at ease right away, but it certainly makes it a human interaction, which is obviously very important.
Yeah, I think our brains are, you know, we're social animals, so I think we're geared toward to respond to that. So if someone's across the table from you and you have a disagreement with them, it's a lot harder to be horrible to them than if they're anonymous and online. I don't,
for sure.
I think there's no better vindication of Hobbes's Leviathan than the internet.
Yeah, you nasty, know, brutish, and short, right? That's what we are online.
yeah. When you don't have that, those controlling, you know, social cues, you know, how do you behave in a vacuum? you're an animal. So what have I not asked you that I should have?
I don't know. I kind of said a lot of things I wanted to say, just regardless of whether it answered your question. So nothing occurs to me right away. Okay. I will just say that that a lot of people are kind of stuck with a very narrow set of tools when it comes to entertaining themselves, and I've never really felt that pigeonholed into only having a few avenues of entertaining myself, and I attribute a lot of that to role-playing games and the expansion of imagination that they give you.
So Hansen Bergamini, thanks for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you, man.
We will be back in a moment and talk with Dr. John Gastel from Penn State University after this. At the midpoint break in most podcasts, you would hear the advertisement from a sponsor. At Sklo Library, though, we have nothing to sell you. We just want to enrich the cultural lives of everyone in central Pennsylvania. That's why all our underwriters are from fiction. This episode's promotional consideration is provided by Prescott Pharmaceutical's Vaxadream, the only toothpaste recommended by Dr. Stephen T. Colbert, DFA. Vaxadream does not contain any antifreeze. In truth, it is certified not to contain anything stronger than glass cleaner and beef tallow. Kissing someone who brushes with Vaxadream is like making out with the cleaning crew at a steakhouse. Side effects include Arby's mouth, brain tooth, scrappy doism, REO speed lung, armpit homunculus, argyle pattern baldness, and Lou Ferrigno's. Prescott Pharmaceuticals, the industry leader in recall efficiency. If you have an underwriter from fiction you would like to see sponsor the show, send your advertisement copy to bdrain@sklolibrary.org. We are back. In this episode, we are talking about role-playing. We are rejoined by friend of the show, Dr. Gastel from Penn State University. He's a distinguished professor in communication arts and sciences and political science, and a senior scholar at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. We had Dr. Gastel on the podcast a few episodes ago, talking about his work on deliberative democracy, but during that, we discovered we both had a love of gaming, and Dr. Gastel has recently published a new novel called Dungeon Party, where the culture of role-playing is a major theme. So we wanted to have him back on to talk about role-playing as a practice. Dr. Gastel, thanks for joining us today.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be here, and I must ask for your listeners that you give a quick autobiography, because it turns out you have a bit of expertise in this area yourself.
It's true that tabletop game design is a passion of mine, and though I haven't designed any role-playing games, they do have a special place in my heart. I would assume something has drawn you to role-playing as well, to feature it so prominently in your novel.
Well, I think something drew it to me when I was younger, and something different drew it to me now. When I was younger, in junior high and high school, I wanted something to do with friends that might make us closer. I played it with people I knew to varying degrees, and I found it was something, a bond we had in common. It's almost like a secret, right? You know, we did pretty conventional stuff when I was in junior high. I mean, we went to dragons' lairs and things like that. And, you know, to an adult, that might seem trite, but to us, it was incredible. And we had stories that we had now lived through together. Well, not every one of our characters lived through them, but it was something really special and kept me in touch with a couple of those people actually all the way through my life. When I played the superhero games more in college, there was something different going on. It was kind of exploring something inside myself. I would play characters who were flawed, had real tragic parts to their story. And I wasn't very in touch with those parts of me, but I was kind of experiencing them in my characters. And I think that was healthy for me. Then there was a period where for years, I didn't really play these role-playing games, and I've come back to them in recent years. And what's funny, what drew me back to them is, again, friendship. It's wanting to be able to see some people regularly and play these games. And we started doing that well before COVID. And now during it, even playing by Zoom, these people who most of them actually are not as well known to me as my older friends, but they've become very important to me. And I really care about them and their characters and the stories we're telling together. So I guess in a way, the reason I started is the reason I do now, is that these role-playing games let you kind of explore yourself in a context where you're getting to know other people. And that's a really fun setting to kind of grow and to grow, in some cases, some new friendships.
Part of what drives the plot of your novel Dungeon Party is a role-playing competition. How could judges decide who plays a game based on imagination the best?
Well, that's debated in Dungeon Party. The Middle Mirth Convention is the annual convention in San Diego, California, that the main character, Alan, who directs the game that they play, is looking forward to. And there's a lot of turbulence, and his group breaks up very early in the novel, which lets me bring in completely new characters, people for him to have at the gaming table. And so they debate among themselves. One of these new players is, in fact, considering going off to grad school in English literature at Yale. And she kind of has the biggest sort of theory of games and how you tell stories well. And what they come to kind of understand is not that complicated. It's a combination of two things. One, the game director has to write a sort of sketch of a module. Like, here's the situations and story that my characters are going to go through. And so that's part of it. That's kind of like a writing competition, right? That's easy. But the second part is where I think it's more interesting of, okay, who tells the best story, right? It's one thing to have written it, but as you say, it's kind of collaborative fiction. So the judges are walking around the room watching the groups interact. And it's not about who can check a table most quickly or whose dice look the best. It's about which game you can't look away from, right? It's too compelling. Maybe there's incredible conflict among the players. Maybe it almost feels personal, right? Like they're so inhabiting their characters that when the thief pickpockets one of the other players in their group, they take it as an affront. Maybe there's a paladin who is committed to righteousness and feels that, well, now it's my duty to punish you. You know, God knows what they have in mind, right? That's interesting. That's conflict, right? So how you manage the cooperation among the players and keep the conflict lively is part of the challenge for any gaming group. And that's what the judges would be looking for, is who's telling the most compelling story live in this gaming convention.
Do you have any words of wisdom to a gaming group just getting started? What should a game director be most cognizant about?
That game director needs to have a real strong sense of narrative. They need to know when the story is starting to lag, when people are getting kind of obsessing about the details. You know, if 1 minute of an elaborate combat sequence between you and some, you know, five-headed giant, it's only taken about a minute in the game world, but you've been doing it for now 3 hours, something's wrong. So, you know, something's breaking down. But it's not just, you know, managing the details of die rolls. It's is there a compelling motivation here, right? Why are we in the desert wandering around? Are we just looking for fellow wandering monsters? Or is there something we care about that our characters are driven to? Something that's astounding to those who played these games back in the 70s and 80s and now see them flourishing today. Games like Dungeons and Dragons have more active users than they ever have had. Something astounding is to watch these podcasts, listen to them in many cases, but other times watch them, which there are millions of people now following other people playing these games. Their listeners feel super engaged. They create fan art, fan fiction about the character. They're completely invested in this world. And I think that's an incredible tribute to the game itself. The little set of books or pamphlets that told you how this game works has been inhabited by people who have made their version of it so compelling that people will just stop whatever they're doing and listen to it or watch it for hours every week.
Have you been surprised that games, including tabletop games, but role-playing games in particular, have continued to flourish with the rise of video games?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that video games are so immersive for people who are sighted that it's hard to kind of beat that. The limited ability of video games to completely capture the gaming market tells us something about human beings and their imagination and the kind of way they like to play, right? I enjoy video games. I played Red Dead Redemption as a game I've super enjoyed. And when I took a class on video gaming, actually by a Penn State professor, Michael Schmierbach, when I learned about these games, there are some games that are just kind of relaxing, right? And I realized I'm playing this Western video game every morning for about an hour just to kind of chill out, ride my horse around, you know, go fishing, whatever. That's a really funny experience. I can't get that from playing a fantasy role-playing game with a bunch of friends. It's me just chilling out, right? But the use of your active imagination in a role-playing game, the fun, unknown unfolding of the story, I think has a strong hold on its part of the gaming marketplace. So in retrospect, you know, it shouldn't be that surprising that that kind of game has a hold, and the tabletop game has its own appeal. I think people are, you know, going to want, it's really just like anything else in life. You want kind of a variety, right? You don't always want to go to the same kind of cuisine. Well, maybe you just don't always want to play the same kind of game.
Speaking of historical trends, have you noticed an increase in women participating in role playing over time?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it. I mean, it just happened. but yeah, I think the games have become much smarter. And one of the things we're seeing with a lot of older games like Dungeons and Dragons is they're having a bit of a reckoning about their content. And these issues come up in Dungeon Party. I touch on one of the older problems in the game, which is the concept of race, which the game puts front and center, but it means something different by the word. But it can't escape the problematic nature of elves versus dwarves versus ogres and so on. And I think it's really refreshing. One of the funnier videos I've seen recently is one of those old takes on The Lord of the Rings, which says, what if Sauron is actually a revolutionary leader and the orcs are the oppressed?
There is an unofficial sequel to Lord of the Rings written by a Russian author where
yes!
the thesis.
Yes, just the other day, in fact, that came up. But the point is, you know, Lord of the Rings can be whatever you want it to be. But I think there's enough room for us to give new readings to it. Well, when we look back through the lens of gender and race and other critical perspectives, we may look at the games very differently. Playing these games, I think, less than, you know, being, you know, problematic for the way language is used in a rule book, I think playing these games is a great way to kind of explore your own sense of the world and maybe become a little bit more open to difference. I mean, how can you help but but kind of see the world through broader eyes when you take these very different roles in life. Right. So that's exciting to me, is that as problematic as some of these older games can be in their text, there's still potentially powerful ways for you to think through other people's experiences and come up with a broader kind of view of the world and the problems we face in this real one.
So you just underlined what I think is so great about role-playing games, and that is player agency. In no other media can you instantly adjust the content to be whatever you want it to be. If you don't like any aspect of the game, you have the power to do whatever you want with it and don't have to lobby a vendor for a solution. Although I do think it's good publishers are also doing their part. No one should feel disinvited from playing. So where can folks learn more about your new novel, Dungeon Party?
Oh, well, you can go online. You can go to johngastel.com. You can type it into your favorite browser, or you can go to Webster's Bookstore here in town. Elaine's got a couple signed copies. I'd be happy to sign more. And I love supporting the local bookstore. And you can support independent booksellers online as well and even order from your favorite store through online portals. But if you go to johngastel.com, all those links are there for you to find it. And I'm happy to say there's an audiobook version read by Victor Bavine, who is perhaps most famous for voicing many, many stories by R.A. Salvatore.
Well, Dr. Gastel, thanks for joining us today.
It was a real pleasure, and I love this program, and it's fun getting to talk about a novel like Dungeon Party with a new group of listeners. So thanks for all the great work you do at Scholar Library, and thanks for this podcast.
Thank you.
In our discussion of role-playing, folks mentioned Dungeons & Dragons quite a bit, and so I looked around to see what would be a fitting poetry nightcap with a fantasy theme. It comes by way of Karen Polwart, inspired by the short story Witch by George Mackay Brown. Read by permission, this is The Dreadful End of Mariana for Sorcery by Karen Polwart. Mariana o' the Howe was a young lassie with golden hair, sweet and honest, true and bonny, and lover of one John Sinclair. Mariana met the factor, at the dawning, at the fold, and he said, "Lie with me now, Mariana, and you will not want for gold." "Well, I thank you for your offer, but I fear it cannot be. I'm on line with John Sinclair, for he's the only one for me." So the factor, sore, affronted, whispered evil of her name. Every sorrow and misfortune was Mariana was to blame. Soon there came a deputation, Mariana for to see, for to slight her reputation. "The deal has laid his hands on thee. You've soured the cream and blighted the corn and danced with fairies on the hill, ye who are devil-born and ye who bow to no man's will." 7 evenings, 7 mornings, they spoke of Mariana ill. There they shamed her, stripped her, and maimed her, but they never tamed her will. Let her sweetness not deceive you. Evil hides itself right well. Once within, it will never leave you. Mariana, you'll burn in hell. "Who are these who stand against me? Who are these who slight my name? Let them tell their lies before God, and let them hang their heads in shame." Then she saw a sight that grieved her, and all the hope inside her died. John Sinclair, all clad in satin, standing at the factor's side. "I was child, and now a woman, but I shall be no man's wife, for my love has me forsaken, and I want no more of this life. They've shorn the hair from Mariana, the witch's snare of golden thread, marched her to the gallows ha, and whipped their sair until she bled." In the crowd she spied her lover, and he had his new coat on. Soon the flames danced all above her, and the people danced till the dawn. Mariana o' the Howe was a young lassie with golden hair, sweet and honest, true and bonny, betrayed by the factor and John Sinclair. This podcast is produced by SCLO Center Region Library. Thanks for our guests for joining us. If you would like to get involved in any of the role-playing groups going on at SCLO Library, send any inquiries to refdesk@sklolibrary.org, and there's a link in the episode description. All sorts of other awesome stuff is going on here, and you can get the skinny on it all at sklolibrary.org. I'm Ben Drain, your old friend and erstwhile companion. Take care until we meet again.